Okay, everyone, hands up if you're hot. Yeah. So it's the end of the day. Everyone's kind of thinking about how much coffee they've drunk and how much they want to go to the pub. But we've got the final session where we're going to take this from a kind of slightly UK-focused debate to a more global, less US, less UK-focused, more global perspectives on digital rights. I want to get the audience involved really early on. We're going to take some... we're going to ask the panellists to give them a short introduction on this issue first, to start thinking about good questions. I'm Mike Harris. I'm the campaign director of Don't Spy On Us, which is the UK campaign to push back on mass state surveillance done by the GCHQ and the NSA, of which Open Rights Group is a key partner. I'd like to introduce the panel. I'll start at that end. We've got Emilia Anderstotter, who is a former Pirate Party member of the European Parliament and was the Pirate Party candidate for president of the European Commission. That's right, isn't it? Yeah, brilliant. And we've also got Eric King, who is the deputy director of Privacy International. And Privacy International is another campaign member of Don't Spy On Us. We're also joined by Gillian C. York, who is the global director of Freedom of Expression for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So I'll start with, and I want this to be as positive as possible, I want us to be talking about solutions to digital rights violations rather than kind of going through the problems again. But I am going to start with a problem question. We know about the UK and US surveillance programs, but globally, I'd like the panel to answer the question of, can they identify another country or another specific problem when it comes to digital rights that we should be keeping an eye on? So, Amelia, can you start?
The European Commission has announced that there will be a copyright reform in 6 months. I'm sure that it will be nowhere near as progressive as most of us would want, but it is looking as if it will be quite a lot better than what we already have. And so once that proposal comes from the Commission, there will be a lobby storm in Brussels. And so it's very, very important that you are engaging your local communities in how to keep the MEPs aware and members of the European Parliament, but hopefully also the governments, depending on their positions, that this is an important issue, that where they need to stay strong and where other interests than those that have the money and time to be present 24 hours every day in Brussels represent. So European copyright reform, endless opportunities to the future.
Eric?
So for me, I think one of the issues, it's slightly tied to what we've been finding out about in the last year and a half around NSA and GCHQ, but it's our agencies, those agencies' relationship with other countries and partners around the world. So the Five Eyes Alliance, within themselves, are known as second parties, but there are third parties to that alliance as well. And for the first time, we now know the details of which countries are involved in this, and we're beginning to get more information than we've ever had before about the kind of relationship that exists between these agencies. For me, this is such a big problem and something we've got to look at a whole lot more, because in essence what we're doing is we're spreading the problem that we've got here with GCHQ and NSA around the rest of the world. So now when NSA wants a new access in a foreign country, rather than going there, rather than unlawfully tapping the cable itself, it works in conjunction with the Ethiopian government or the Vietnamese government. It provides them the money to install the equipment to tap those big fibers, to tap those big cables. In exchange, the Vietnamese government, the Ethiopian government, gets the receipt of all the intelligence collected there, but so does NSA and so does GCHQ. And so with this, we're basically creating these tentacles around the world that are feeding towards the NSA mothership, but at the same time are normalizing these practices in all these other countries, providing this technology with almost no safeguards, almost no use. We've got to do something about this. We've got to stop this now, otherwise we're going to end up in a situation where every cable is tapped in every country everywhere with slightly different arrangements where you can't share X with Y, but you can share A with B. Intelligence sharing is the bit of the puzzle, raw intelligence sharing. This is really important. Not just intelligence sharing, not just finalized dossiers, not PDFs where you slip it out of a manila envelope and hand it over, but the raw bulk intelligence sharing, I think, is going to be the big fight for the next 10 or so years around this stuff, and this is what we've got to go and fight on.
Yeah, so nobody's mentioned censorship yet, so I'm going to get to that instead. One of the things that has been really bothering me is looking at the way that corporations enable censorship and are completely complicit with authoritarian and non-authoritarian governments that want to limit speech. So to give an example of this, Facebook last week put out their latest transparency report, or what they call their government requests report. And it does look at data, user data requests. I'm not going to focus on that at the minute, although that is also a huge problem. But when I was looking at the censorship requests in particular, the three top countries on that list were India, which Facebook does have offices there, and I'll get to that point in just a moment, Turkey and Pakistan. Now, Turkey and Pakistan did not use the mutual legal assistance treaties to get that data. They just send a police order, a legal order of some kind, to the company, and the company takes down whatever they demand. They're under no legal obligation to do so in the manner in which this is done. If you look at Twitter, if you look at other companies, they're doing the same things. And actually, I think Pakistan is really notable in this case because earlier this year, they sent a legal order to Twitter, the Pakistani Telecommunications Authority specifically. Twitter took down the content, and then a week later realized that the legal order wasn't so legal and put the content back up. Facebook doesn't even subject it to that kind of scrutiny. They just take down thousands of pieces of content every day. And so I think that what we're really looking at is the ways that companies are enabling governments to be repressive.
So I'd like us now to turn the conversation to something a bit more positive and get the panel to give us some examples of positive global success stories in the field of digital rights, whether that's a politician taking initiative or a grassroots civil society NGO taking initiative. Can you give us one example where we can be heartened at civil society fighting back? Amelia, do you want to start?
I'm prejudiced towards still saying the European copyright reform. We've had some excellent leadership from the European Commission in the past year, actually, where they've dared to ask a lot of very difficult questions about whether the current copyright framework is sufficient. Also, the European Commission has had the courage to write in their summary of consultation responses all of the important aspects around controversial copyright, including stuff like censorship and surveillance done for copyright infringement purposes that private citizens in the European Union brought up with them. If you read through the Commission consultation summary of responses, you will see that they've really taken to heart a lot of the wise things that people say. But, of course, we're still facing the problem of how can we nurture and support what appears to be, at least to me, a quite radical shift in how the civil servants of the European Commission are viewing copyright, which is also which has been driving a lot of technological development for these companies like Twitter and Facebook also, in a way that enables censorship and oppression. So again, copyright, very positive, but a lot of work ahead.
Eric?
So I'm going to talk about something that I was involved in, but it in no way was the result of my work alone that got us to the success. And this is the commercialization of surveillance. This is the surveillance trade, the export of surveillance technology around the world. 5 years ago, we had an understanding, of course, that companies existed, selling equipment to intelligence agencies and law enforcement in different forms. But we really didn't have a clue as to just how sophisticated this market was, and what an integral role they were playing in pushing surveillance right the way around the world. WikiLeaks 4 years ago, or was it 4 years ago? Three, somewhere too long ago, published the WikiLeaks spy files. This was a big collection of materials collected from a number of people, particularly about one trade show, ISS World. This is a trade show held right the way around the world in which law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies turn up and European and American contractors flog their wares. The dump of this information online, at least for me, opened up a whole new set of actors being able to access knowledge that was previously held by a kind of a specialist few. It was very difficult to to learn about surveillance capabilities technically if you didn't know someone yourself who could talk about it. By pushing this online, by putting the raw documents up, all of a sudden people could take the time to read through them and begin to get to grasps with exactly what was going on and how it all fitted together. Since then, a number of groups, EFF, PI, the Citizen Lab as well at the University of Toronto, have been investigating this industry and writing stories and writing reports about where this equipment goes. We found British companies exporting technology to Bahrain and Ethiopia. EFF are representing an Ethiopian national who was spied on using Finfish's state Trojan from Ethiopia, spying on him while he was in DC. PI are also representing an Ethiopian national. He's in the United Kingdom. He was spied on, again, from the intelligence agencies in Ethiopia when he was in his home in Greenwich. This is these are things that we didn't have the facts on. We didn't have things that we could do anything about 4 or 5 years ago. We've now got court cases going on against it. The other big thing is that we've now got export controls on some surveillance technology. It's been a big question, a big debate about whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. I've spoken here at this conference before about why I think they're a very important tool. They're not the only tool, but a very important one in the toolbox. The European Commission are going to be introducing these new controls in 2 months' time. There are big carves out for security research. There are big carves out for open source research and open source software. But all of a sudden, we're going to be having new laws in place preventing, making it really, really difficult for some of these companies to export their, frankly, evil around the world. This is something that didn't exist just 4 years ago, and now we've had real change.
So I'm just going to tell a small story about why I think that national level advocacy and activism is important. This is a really small story, but it's a personal one. So a couple years ago, I was in an airport and I got a phone call from a journalist who was working in the Palestinian Authority. And he had discovered that about 8 to 10 news websites were being filtered, blocked by the ISPs there. And so he asked me if there was any way that that could be investigated. So I sent him to a couple of researchers who were using UniProbe, which you may have heard of, and they were able to detect and determine what exactly was being blocked. So we gave that information back to the journalist, allowed him to have that scoop, and we also reported on it. And as a result of that, a communications minister was angry about that censorship happening and resigned. I think he's now working with ISOC. Oddly enough. But that was just such a small story. And actually, just so you, for the those interested in the tech on this, they were using Squid to block the websites, which I thought was kind of funny. But anyway, so that's just a really small story about how just a few phone calls and a few people can make some small change happen. But I do a lot of work in the Middle East and North Africa, and a lot of those changes really all have to happen at the national level. There's no, you know, you don't have a union there. You don't have some sort of governing body that allows these to happen at a broader level. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing is trying to get Jordan not to censor news websites. Right now they're censoring almost 300 news websites unless they get licensed. And that's the sort of advocacy that we support and work with them on. Similar things are happening all throughout that region. And I think that, you know, there may not be a place for everyone to work on that specific advocacy, but whatever country you're from, wherever you're working, there's always something happening at the national level that's important as well.
So day two of AuCon is all about how we as digital rights activists can make a difference, how we can promote social change, cultural change, political change, and legal change. And I want to ask the panel, looking globally at what digital rights activists are doing, what would you say are the most effective strategies for change? Is there anything, are there any campaigns you've seen or any strategies that have been used that have really, for you, been a very effective model that perhaps Open Rights Group and other groups in the UK can copy? Gillian, I'll start with you.
I'm not going to focus on one model. I think that any change that happens can't... I mean, so talking about the surveillance debate, for example, I don't think that there's any one solution. A lot of people will talk about the technology side of things and how, you know, we can only take individual responsibility by using this tool or this tool, and that's the best way for us to prevent X, Y, or Z. That's one piece of it. I think that you also have to look at the legal fight, the policy fight, and then the fourth one, which I don't think it's talked about as much, but changing societal norms and changing beliefs around what's appropriate in terms of privacy, in terms of surveillance. And so I see it as sort of, you know, four quarters, maybe there's a fifth that I'm not even thinking of, but four quarters to the whole. I think that we have to look at the, you know, fights in the courts, fights in policymaking venues, but also technology to take individual responsibility, and that last piece, really kind of looking at society as a whole, and is this the world that we want to live in?
I think everything that Gillian says is exactly right. There's not a single way that we win all the fights that we care about. It's about talking to people. It's about publishing. It's about technology, and it's about legal action as well. The one thing I'd say, which I think we can be doing a lot more of, and I'm really pleased that we are doing more about it, is on the litigation side of things. In the US, litigation has long been a tool for public interest advocacy and work. Around the rest of the world, it's been a tool, but less so when it comes to digital rights issues, surveillance issues. And I think that's been a real missed opportunity. Some of the greatest successes in campaigns that I've been working on have been via taking these legal actions. In our case against GCHQ, well, I'll tell you, so 2 years ago, well, a bit longer ago than that, you know, I was trying to read Ripper and trying to understand how the spooks were interpreting a whole series of sections. And I had no idea. I mean, I could read it 10 different ways, but I didn't know how they were reading it. So, of course, you try and FOI something and it's protected, you're not going to get anything back. You start talking to people at the MOJ, no one's going to talk to you. You try and talk to people in pubs, no one's going to talk to you about it. As soon as we filed our first lawsuit, 2 weeks later, I got GCHQ's full legal argument. And I went, huh. Okay, yeah, I should have done this a lot longer ago. I have learned more about how GCHQ legally justifies mass surveillance in the course of this litigation than I had done in the previous 5 or 6 years I was working on these points. There is so much more work that we can be doing by leveraging these kind of tool sets. Right the way across Europe, there are these public interest lawyers, there are these public interest litigators, particularly those that are dealing with national security and counterterrorism issues, who are sympathetic and understand many of the things that we're all concerned about here. What they don't know is they don't know the technical side of intelligence. They don't know how all that works and how all that functions. And it takes people to go to them and explain to them how this works, what this means. When you see this, what does that imply and how it all fits together? I think that if together we can be putting more information out in the public domain to allow others to be able to understand this with an aim, this is for my benefit as well, but to go and get more pieces of litigation taken in different countries, I think this is the one area where I've got real hope for the next 10 years is on taking cases that we've never before had the chance to take. Finding things out, taking new ones, and building on that.
I'm going to slightly tweak the question for Amelia. So you were obviously inside the European Parliament, and so people would come and lobby you as a legislator. So what did you see as effective tactics used by civil society to push back, in the digital rights sphere?
So, right, because I would probably agree with everything that Julian and Eric are saying if I had also had the civil society experience. And I think somehow it's a failure of politicians that somebody is sitting here praising courts as the proper way of getting political change, because clearly that somehow in the democratic system that's supposed to be people like me who aspire to represent in a publicly elected institution. What happens in Brussels is that very few politicians in Brussels are dependent on campaign funding, so it's radically different from Washington. It's actually a quite ethical place where you can make a lot of impact only by knowing your way around and being extremely savvy. When people speak about the Brussels bubble, there's a certain truth to that, in that whoever is acknowledged in the Brussels bubble as being the foremost authority on something will normally get an enormous amount of influence, to the point where it's actually scary how much influence people can have, only by, even if they're like civil society activists, right? But one particular case where everyone who was knowledgeable and ethical in the civil society and that had done a lot of research and what have you had the upper hand was actually the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. And so the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is the first time when a European institution has turned a proposal down from the European Commission only by having public protests encouraging them to do so. Some of you may have experience from the software patents campaign between 2002 and 2005, but Microsoft actually turned on that proposal in 2005. They lobbied the parliament against it alongside with the software anti-software patent campaigners. In ACTA, there was nothing like that. There was not a single industry group that asked for ACTA to be turned down. There were only like 2.5 million Polish people who were in the streets in Poland in the middle of January saying that we don't want this agreement, please get rid of it. And then a few million like Romanians and Slovenians and Slovakians followed, and the members became so unsettled by this, because normally if there's a protest in the member state, you will go to the parliament and then nobody else will know about it, so you're kind of safe in Brussels. But with the ACTA agreement, there was really no safe place. Everyone was affected equally by all of the aggressive protests all over, and the parliament was eventually able to say no. And so my conclusion from that is that local activities and having empowering local people to feel how Brussels is impacting them and being able to use the right means of influence to impact their MEPs can actually have a real benefit. And so you need the civil society people in Brussels as well, like kind of the Brussels bubble people, because they can provide insights and knowledge and policy papers and all of these things. But if you don't have the local support there, the members get kind of lost. Now, of course, an effective way of doing that is sitting outside on the street for 2 weeks in January. And so one of my foremost priorities for the future is finding out whether there's other activities that are more relaxing and less cool to do that one can also do to show a similar level of engagement in European policy at the local level. And I believe that there's going to be a workshop on the copyright reform tomorrow, and I strongly encourage people to go there, because I think we're not necessarily fighting an uphill fight. I mean, it's a bit uphill, but it's not necessarily as much uphill as we would expect it to be. And so this could be actually like a real opportunity where the people in Brussels will be desperately needing our constant reminders that they are creating future laws for us. And because the law in copyright is also very bad, it doesn't matter the amount of litigation you do, because you always end up kind of on the losing end. So it's a very important reform, and please show up at the workshop and do consider that in the next 5 to 7 years or so.
Oh, okay. Can I see a show of hands on questions? That's a reasonable number. Can we have questions, not statements? Global perspectives is the frame. So, and try and keep the questions about what we're kind of talking in we're trying to talk about positive solutions to the challenges we face. I'll take questions in three. I'll take this lady here, the gentleman there, and then this gentleman here.
Just to pick up on one thing, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name.
Eric.
You said 5 years ago, we just had no idea we knew there were state surveillance products out there, but we just didn't know what they did. What is it that we're now saying that about? In 5 years' time, when you're back here, what are you going to say? Well, you know, back in 2014 if only we'd known about me?
Very good question. Very good question. Miss Jen, yeah.
You're talking about ties to trade regulations with the EU in terms of that battery source mass spare technologies. How do you think it's going to work on the after recently there's been the regulation by GAMA, international selling from Germany with no license agreements? How do you think that plays into the wider conversation about sort of about trade agreements, or whether the WASM and WASMA agreement needs to be tweaked or things like that? I mean, how do you see that moving forward? Obviously, there's an optimism, but there's a wider question.
Right. Okay. Well, Gillian, do you want to start?
Sure. I can answer a little bit on the first two questions, but I'm afraid I can't answer specifically on the Italian question. I've had that tab open for days. I've been meaning to read it, and it's like it's in the backlog of things that I need to look at. But on the question of internet bills of rights more generally, I have to say I'm a bit of a skeptic. I think A, because we've gone down this road before many, many times, but B, also because, not specific to Italy, again, I have not researched that one, so I'm going to the Arab IGF next month in Beirut, and one of the things that has been created is a regional Arab Internet Bill of Rights that Vint Cerf signed on to ceremoniously at the IGF, and I'll tell you, like, flat out, it's bullshit. It's funded by the U.S. government, it's culturally relativist, it's just terrible on every level. And yet you've got people like Vint Cerf just happily signing on, because he probably didn't even read it, to be honest with you. And so I worry that when we nationalize rights in that way around the internet, I think that's just not how the internet functions. It's not how it operates. At the same time, I mean, I'm not saying those can't be... They can't serve some purpose, and so I'll have to look into that one to see if it's more useful. And on the second question, my answer to that was going to be, and I sort of jokingly whispered it, but I kind of mean it, once Europe can't export these technologies anymore, who's going to build them next, would be my question.
Mm-hmm. Eric?
So I'll start with the question about Wassenaar and Germany exporting. So... going against companies that are selling surveillance equipment is basically like playing whack-a-mole, right? You know, they've got. I mean, with GAMA alone, we think we've got 26 different subsidiaries or linked international companies, either in the BVI or you know, everywhere else. It's an absolute minefield. It's a complete nightmare. They are splitting profits right the way through that. They're exporting different sections from different bits of companies. This is what these kinds of companies do. For me, I think that they weren't doing this 4 years ago. 4 years ago, they just exported from the UK. And the fact that they've now had to move to this system, many would say you've pushed the problem somewhere else. For me, I think it's actually a success because they now know what they're doing is wrong. It's evil, right? And... I think there's a really important thing to that. At these trade shows, one of the biggest things that I'm kind of proud of is that we managed to... They didn't let anybody in who wasn't accredited by at least five other people at the trade shows, right? Because they were so scared about people infiltrating these trade shows and exposing their secrets, right? When they were going around and leaving the conference, they had to take off their badges and put them in their bags because there were people outside who were asking them questions, journalists with cameras. Right, and the fact that they're now knowing that what they're doing, they're having to go up to hotel rooms and have secret meetings, I think that's a really important first step, that they know that what they're doing is not acceptable, that society is not going to tolerate it, and if they're going to do it, fine, but they're going to have to do it in the shadows. So I see that first and foremost as a win. On the what do we now do about it, there's lots of tools that we've got. So the Wassenaar arrangement that you mentioned is kind of the closest thing to an international club agreeing to things that will be subject to export control. Germany is part of that. In essence, it ends up covering about 50 countries around the world, including states that aren't signed up to it, like Israel. So Israel aren't a member of Wassenaar, but they do follow it. In a month and a half's time is when these controls are going to be implemented, are going to be introduced for the first time. That is when GAMA are going to have to start getting licenses. Up until now, the only way that GAMA have been caught is, and this is funny, is they've been caught because export controls still do control cryptography. Now, many people don't realize that, right? But export controls do still control cryptography. And when we asked our export control authority, does Gamma need a license? They said, yes, they should do, because they use cryptography. So you can imagine, you know, I was sitting in the office going, huh, what do we do about this? What we ended up saying is, right, well, do we want cryptography to be controlled? No. All right, can we change this in this circumstance? No. Do we want the guys who have created the software to go to jail for this? Yes. Fine. Well, we're going to give it to the export control authorities. We're going to say they did need a license. They didn't get it. They should have got it. They need to be investigated. And we're going to use every single resource at our opportunity to say cryptography should never be export controlled. And now when you look at every single one of our submissions, that is what we say. So up until now, Gamma's really been caught on the basis of that. It's not catching the core bit of their product. In a month and a half time, they will. Maybe they're going to move to Lebanon. Maybe they're going to move somewhere else. Who knows? But that's why you have different tools. That's why you take litigation against them. With civil actions in the US, criminal actions here in the UK, you know, collectively they can be done there. On the question of what's going to be the thing in the, did we wish we knew in 5 years? I spent a lot of my time trying to answer that question. One of them, I think, is something I've already hinted at, which is intelligence sharing. I really, really do think that this is a huge part of the puzzle that, while all of us do know about this, right? I mean, GCHQ, NSA swapping material, I mean, of course we say it all the time. But in terms of actually going to go and do something about it, and the quantity, just the sheer scale of the information that's being exchanged here and how that works, I think is something that we still don't appreciate. I was speaking to someone who works for a European intelligence agency, and they said that 70% of the raw material that that agency crunches through comes from the US. 70%. You wonder why states aren't going out to criticizing NSA. You know, it's because their whole security apparatus runs on NSA data. And I don't think that we've understood the magnitude of a problem that's going to be to break this club up. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I think, is hacking. I think that state-sponsored intrusion is going to be, dealing with surveillance is going to be tricky. It's going to be really tricky. In some of the stories we've seen that Snowden have released, they've got a new term for it. For the last 70 years, intelligence agencies have been doing signals intelligence, SIGINT. Now they do active SIGINT. That's what they call it. And that is now what they're doing. This is a complete change for many of these agencies, and it's creating perverse incentives in ways that we've never before had to confront. I think this is going to be a really big fight and a really tricky one as well that we're going to be seeing.
Yeah. Well, so I can actually, Eric is very entertaining and he's very correct also. And one of the positive things about these companies now being evil is actually public procurement. How many of you live in municipalities that have procured software, filtering technologies or censorship tools from a company that is also damaging the democratic rights of somebody somewhere else? Yeah. How many of you know people whose children go to schools and libraries who are actively putting your public money into tools that are being used to damage democratic rights elsewhere? And how many people in your communities are aware of that? And is there any way that you can make people object to your municipalities, your libraries, your schools contributing to these oppressive mechanisms? Most people, when you tell them that law enforcement is trying to hack into computers and that there's actually an industry that supplies law enforcement with tools for hacking computers, become concerned, because most people know that there is no crime OS. Criminals use the same tools that we do. So when the law enforcement is hacking criminals, they're also hacking us and making our tools more unsafe. And so I think there is an opportunity there to actually also have locally inspired policies for doing something. I wanted to call in on the Bill of Rights thing, and I guess somebody in Italy will, because I know some of the people who were involved in that. But my experience from a legislative institution is that this really doesn't matter at all. I mean, I'm more than skeptical. I'm actually probably antagonistic towards these ideas, because we know that what impacts members of parliament in their daily work is basically who they meet and who they talk to and where they feel pressure from. And so there's lots of nice documents with pieces of text everywhere, and they get sent these, you know, by the dozen a day from different interest groups. The most endearing one that I ever received was from the European Milk Board. They represent continental European milk dairy farmers. And so these are just one of the many different documents that you can receive when you're in a public institution. What we need is for our politicians to actually respect human rights. I mean, I have a quite strong conviction that the European Convention of Human Rights, for instance, or even the Fundamental Charter of Human Rights that is now incorporated in the EU framework agreements, are sufficient. The only thing we need to do is to apply all of these things online as well. And rather than distracting politicians with yet another document, why not try to effectively make politicians adhere to agreements they already signed? The International Convention on Political and Civic Rights.
Great. I'm going to take number three questions. We're slightly getting tight on time. So, over here. It's in the back, actually. Yeah, a bit of a walk. But.
So, the panel did commenting mostly on conventional forms of lobbying. Can you comment on slightly less conventional, more radical things like direct action? For example, the idea of starting off the water to the NSA data centre.
Right, I'm gonna take this from over this side, so just to the back there.
One of the benefits of free internet is that it goes across the borders. We're now seeing more and more balkanisation across the internet, whereas the real global hegemony is at the corporate level, whereas us users are still being forced into the legal frameworks of the nation state. It's one of the problems here, that we're sticking the taxonomy of a bygone era, and we need to take this actual fight and take this discussion up to the point where we're actually operating at the same levels as these clubs of balkanised states are operating.
One last question? No? Okay. Gillian, do you want to start?
I'm not sure I got the question part of that one. I was trying to listen, but...
It was... The issue is the balkanisation of the internet, so the reimposition of national boundaries on the internet. How do we tackle that?
Oh, I need to think about that one.
Okay. Eric, do you want to start?
We can do direct action.
You always go for the fun ones. Come on.
Do you want to do that one first? Okay, you go.
The balkanisation of the internet seems to me to be a bit of a marketing strategy from Google and Yahoo and all of these big American companies, when they're basically upset that people are now suspicious of American services because they make money from people using them. So I'm not overly concerned about this. I'm sorry if I emphasize this far too much. I don't think that our problem is that we have too few NGO people traveling around to global conferences all over the world.
Right.
So maybe I'm symptomatic of this problem somehow also, but I have this, I've been in the Internet Governance Forum now, and you realize there's like 10, 15 new NGOs that I've never heard about that just suddenly come to all of the meetings, and they go to the Plenipot in South Korea on the ITU, and they have lots of money, and the issue reports by the dozen. But actually, who cares? When I talk to my mom about this, she has no idea. She gets extremely worried, but she has no idea. And she is related to me, so you can imagine that she is anyway somebody who has quite a lot of clues in comparison with a lot of people. Our problem is, if we're really dealing with a global infrastructure that we believe is of use to a broad global audience, how do we convince this broad global audience that this is actually the case? How do we bring this down to people at the local level in a way that is tangible and relevant for them? And if we can do that, I think normally these global situations will eventually sort out as well.
Yeah, I have to agree. I've been to one internet governance forum. No, I think the regional ones are a bit different for different reasons, and I think a lot of that depends on the region and whatnot. As I mentioned, I'm going to one soon, but I've been to one of the big ones, and I found it the biggest waste of time. I just found, you know, a lot of talk and not a lot of action. And I, you know, I sympathize with this a lot as somebody who has done that whole circuit, and I'm now kind of turning and focusing a little bit more on education for that reason. We started a publication last year on digital rights in the Arab world, and that's something that I think is, you know, trying to reach ordinary people. On the Balkanization question, though, the irony about the companies in this respect is that they're simultaneously fear-mongering about it while also enabling it. And that, to me, is just unconscionable. I think that we need a lot more education on the role of corporations, and I think that's something that definitely doesn't get a lot of attention. On the direct action comment, there's not much that I can say. Look, I mean, I work for an organization. It's not, you know, but I think, like, to take one example, distributed denial of service attacks. This has been a really interesting debate, and there's a great book out right now, really soon, or now, by Molly Sauter on this issue, on whether or not this is activism, whether this is... And look, to me, I can see the value in it as activism. Every instance of direct action comes with the threat. I mean, the whole point of it, right, comes with the threat of potential legal interference. But... you know, I also think when I look at DDoS attacks, when I look at the effectiveness of these as a form of protest in the case of WikiLeaks, at the same time, I look at the way that states are using them against small independent media. And I can't condone that. And so it's really hard to say, okay, it's okay in this case, but not in this case. Look, if you want to take that risk, what you're doing is essentially taking nonviolent direct action with the threat of law enforcement involvement. And I think that that's fine in the same way that, you know, chaining myself to a building would cause the same threat.
But I have to object. I actually completely support the use of DDoS attacks for political protest purposes. And I think that DDoS should normally be legal. I don't think that extorting small media should be legal, but I also don't consider extorting small... I mean, I wouldn't condone that even if you did it in some other way, with, for instance, knives or other like threats of legal action. I just think media should be free, period. And so some of, but then there's, if you're actually going to like go into the sewers and cut NSA's, you know, water off or something like this, that would be civil disobedience, which, as Gillian already emphasized, it comes at a certain legal risk. In many of the IT cases, though, I think that there's really just been a very strong overreaction from legislators, which you could also see as indicative of them actually being effective, right? Like the WikiLeaks DDoS or the Visa MasterCard things. They actually provoked a really strong political reaction, even if it wasn't the one that they aspired to. But
oh, I agree. I totally agree. I just worry about where you draw that line on legality, and where you draw that line on acceptability and morality too, in terms of the way DDoS is used against smaller actors.
We have lots of previous case law on civil disobedience. I mean, this should normally not be a problem. The courts can sort that out, surely.
So there's, I'm taking off my official. here, but this is being recorded, right? So I should be careful about what I say.
My hat was also off, just for the record.
Yeah, I'm with you. Let's do that. the problem is that I'm a lawyer, and it gets really hard to be condoning some of this, to be saying we should be going to do this stuff while you're aware of all the troubles that it causes. But there's loads of things that I have been wanting to do. About every week, I send an email to all of the staff about an idea that I'm not going to do, but that I want to do. Which has actually become, it's quite a sad list now, because it's like, you know, it's all like my hopes and excitement about the world, and then going, no, that's too risky, which is a shame. Maybe I should tweet them or something instead. One of the things that I wanted to do, it's not a big thing, but it was actually Parker from EFF. He was on, I think, holiday outside in Hawaii. Is that right?
Which thing are you talking about?
Did Parker go to Hawaii for holiday recently?
Yes.
Okay, so he tweeted outside Edward Snowden's house.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a stop sign in the road. And he wrote underneath, stop mass surveillance or NSA spying.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I can get on board with that. That's not breaking any laws.
Like, Berlin is covered in the Asylum for Snowden stickers.
Let's do that here.
I have friends with pockets full of them sticking them up on the wall.
I wanted to go around all over London and write mass surveillance underneath every stop sign
I'm in.
Like, I thought that would be fun. I thought that would be good fun.
With some chalk from the chalk farm.
Yeah, with some chalk, exactly. There you go.
Just as a matter of interest, how many members of the audience think that cutting off the water for the NSA service would be justifiable?
You're not going to entrap us.
I think I already have. I think we can take probably a couple last questions. So do we have any burning desire for questions? Can we just take one last question? That's what we're doing. Just for the record, I'd like to say that the IGF in Bali last year I found extremely useful.
I found the one in the authoritarian country that I went to a couple years ago extremely useful too.
Okay, there's a question for
The bat something, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That scared me.
We'll take some final kind of concluding comments. What's been interesting is the range of responses to the challenges that we face, from pure politics through to direct action, civil action, legal litigation. So it'd be good to get a final set of wrap-up comments on how we use those tools, what do we do in specific instances, because actually a lot of this is going to come through tomorrow for day two of all, which is going to be much more practical, much more focused. Amelia.
I just need to make concluding remarks now.
Yes.
Okay.
And answer that gentleman's question if possible.
Well, but so I come back to this with what I tried to tie into Eric's statements earlier, that if you have companies that are verifiably evil, try to ask your local council people not to buy products from those companies. Because I guess normally people don't want to buy products from evil companies. I see cautious frowns in the audience. I know that, but basically do public procurement things. This is something that can be done locally. I would like to finish off by saying that it's really very important that people get involved in the European copyright reform. There are many ways in which that can go wrong. But if it does not go wrong, that can also be incredibly good. The chances that it will go well increases exponentially the more you are involved. And also when the European Commission has been trying to do the right thing in the face of very powerful lobbies in the past, like with the competitive telecoms reforms or with the data protection reform, we've actually found that the Commission loses to the lobbies because they don't have the right amount of grassroots support. So don't let that happen also in the copyright debate. Do get involved with that and follow it very closely. Thank you.
Eric?
I want to see if I can answer the question, but just give me one line about what the question was at the end.
How do you deal with protecting liberties coming into conflict with fostering innovation?
Looking at around kind of how do we stop bad companies selling bad things to bad places versus but also allowing the research and everything else to flourish and exist?
Kinda.
So the super tricky, super hard. There's a whole lot of stuff that falls firmly in the middle, and it's really, really tricky to know what to do and how to go about it. I mean, we've just finished some investigations in some countries about what intelligence agencies in different countries are using I won't say which countries it is yet, because that's going to be coming out next week. But, you know, the equipment that they're running on is stuff that all of us have and own and, you know, buy. It's, you know, they run on HP servers, you know, right the way through. They use storage from, you know, NetApp. You know, their databases are Oracle databases. I mean, there's not much that we'd want to be doing to be limiting that there, or how you go about it. The EFF have got a... put out a policy paper kind of addressing for companies that are wanting to not have their technology being used for these, you know, socially negative purposes. You know, there's a whole set of things that you can be doing. And for me, on those kind of, on that area of things, that's what I basically say. I say, look, companies, you know, you've got often a big market, and you've got a choice about who and where you're pitching your equipment to. Don't pitch it in situations that you think it's going to have a socially negative end result. And those companies can make those choices. And if we put the pressure on them enough to go and do it, some of them will, some of them won't. And the ones that won't, there are other tools that we can be looking at. You know, as for the wrap-up and you know, what we can all be doing and where we need to be doing now, I think in the last year and a half, we've almost, this is obviously just on the surveillance side of things, we've almost learnt more than we had, like, in the previous 5 years combined. You know, there are still documents I haven't read, and it's my day job to read them. We've got to keep crunching through all this material. We've got to understand it. The journalists have had a really hard job making sense of the documents that they've got. The stories that they've written are one angle on it. There's so much more we could be writing about the material that's been publicly released. I think everyone's still in a position where they're kind of just receiving the information and trying to make sense of it. And if I had an ask of people here, I'd say, if you've seen a couple of connections in documents that have been released, and you don't think somebody's written that up, and, you know, or really dealt with all the facts and the issues, go and write about it. There's a couple of blogs that have been doing that really well. There's one in the Netherlands called Electrospaces. I don't know who writes it, but that dude is tenacious. He is ferocious. He finds things that I'm missing. And, you know, he's writing more interesting stories than the Washington Post is putting out sometimes, yeah. Right? You know, go and read these documents and you know, look for the angle that you think others have missed and write it up and footnote the hell out of it and put it out. And this is what's going to allow us all to understand these things better and make the most out of the heroic act that Edward Snowden did for all of us.
Eric totally stole my answer. No, damn it. No, so to your question, I mean, I think this is why my organization has struggled so much on the question around export controls, to be perfectly honest, because that is a challenge. There is the fear amongst some of our constituents, some of our employees, some of us, that if you limit the export of some of these technologies, you're also going to limit people's ability to develop things. Now, I mean, I personally think, taking the hat off, I think there's a really, really big gap between developing something and selling it. And I do think that we should be looking at that, but I do also understand the caution with which our lawyers have approached this issue in the sense, you know, in the way that the US works and the way that law works there. And so I don't think that it's an easy answer. My sympathies are definitely on the export control side, but I do understand a lot of these risks, and I think that we have to look at them carefully or we are going to stifle innovation. On the whole, I mean, I guess what I really did want to say here was, if we took some of those random NGOs that you run into at the IGF and we put them all on, you know, working on things like education and public outreach and getting everybody's mother and father and grandparents to care about these issues, I think that it would be much more effective. I've tried to stop going to those things. Sometimes it's really hard, man. They really try to pull you in. But I really think that there's so much education that can happen. There's so much teaching that we can do to make people understand, A, that this is a global issue. It's not just Europe. It's not just the West. It's a north-south. It crosses borders. It's a solidarity issue. And I think also just in helping people understand some of these things, and I want to talk really, really quickly and just throw this out there, that when it comes to the technology, since we haven't really touched on that, and particularly the technology and the tools that we use to fight back against surveillance, one of my frustrations for the past few years has been the sort of these things are too hard, or If you don't know how to use that, then you deserve whatever happens to you. That sort of stuff needs to stop right now. And I think we have to... seriously, we need to meet people where they are. We need to approach people at the level that they're at and give them things that they can work with and look at this incrementally rather than looking at some one-size-fits-all solution.
Cool. So we've got a plea to back European copyright reform. We've got a campaign to write mass surveillance under stop signs in London. We're going to hold corporations to account, and we're going to get on people's level when it comes to securing themselves and their tech. We've got a plea to send me to the IGF in the Bahamas in 2016.
Me too.
I think at this point it's customary for a round of applause for our fantastic panel.
Okay, thank you all very, very much for a very busy and hopefully productive day. I'd like to just thank our sponsors, F-Secure and Daniels and Arnold, for their help, particularly in being able to put on the keynote in this last panel. I'd also like to thank Ruth for all their hard work. Speakers, and I think Ruth has a few bits and pieces to give out to them.
Yeah, I have something for Corey. I don't know, is Corey still on the roof?
Yes.
Corey, there's a card and a box of chocolates for you. I have chocolates. It's a very, very warm room, so I'm mildly worried that you're
going to put them in the fridge first, it'll be fine.
Thank you to all the volunteers who've helped put this on today, and to yourself. We're only able to do what we do because of you. I hope to see a lot of you tomorrow, and those of you who can't make it tomorrow, please, firstly, either way, do your feedback forms, please, and give them out on the way out. And hopefully we'll just see you all in the pub at Dr. Inks, which is on Stamford Street. This is on Stamford Street, in a few minutes. So thank you, and good evening.